Welcome to the Training with Casey podcast, where we explore animal training and living our best lives with animals. I'm Joseph Laughlin, producer of this podcast. And now, here is your host, Casey Covert. Let's get started.
Thanks, Joe. Hey, welcome to Training with Casey, and I'm Casey Covert. And today, I would like to talk about how zoo training is fundamentally different than a lot of other kinds of training. You know, for dog trainers, horse trainers, guinea pig trainers. I actually don't know about guinea pig trainers. But a lot of trainers get engaged when the animal has a problem. And they're hired to solve a problem. But it's not like that at zoos. At zoos, trainers have a totally different role. And I think this is the role that all trainers should have. At zoos, the job of a trainer is not to correct the behavior of an animal. It is to prepare that animal for the best, safest, healthiest, longest life that we can help them to gain. We have a cradle-to-grave orientation. We start training the instant that animal comes into the zoo environment. We plan for all the things that we know they need to do. So we'll go into that a little bit more in a minute. We never stop training because training is like relationship. You have to keep maintaining it. You can't train the animal all the way up to a certain level and then, okay, now we're done. This is a trained animal. No, it's a trained animal today. And just like physical conditioning, 3 weeks without physical conditioning, you're no longer in condition, no matter how fit you were. And similarly, relationship and training work the same way. You can't put it on the shelf. You have to maintain that relationship, and the relationship is part, a big part of what motivates the animal to cooperate in what he's learned to do. So, why is dog training different? Well, unfortunately, it's because most people hire a dog trainer because they're in pain. They're in pain because of what the animal does or doesn't do. And they need relief, and they don't know how to get it. They maybe have tried things themselves. So they hire a professional. And they're not necessarily interested in being dog trainers. They just want to be out of pain. So when the professional offers them an opportunity to maybe, you know, learn something fun to do with their animal, maybe they just don't, they're just not interested. I can understand that, right? They already have a life and a job, and they're trying to live it, and their animal is causing them problems, sometimes jeopardizing other, everything they own, and sometimes even jeopardizing people in the family directly. So we rise to the occasion and we get in there and help them. But in reality, those dogs also need what the zoo animals have. They need a complete education teaching them how to live successfully with people, teaching them how to successfully self-manage, teaching them how to make the most of their talents. Because animals need jobs just like people need jobs. We all need to be feeling like we're important, that we make a contribution, that we're good at something, and that we contribute that to the well-being of others. I have seen so many dogs just recreate their lives as soon as they connected with the job they love doing. So, let's talk about how to help the owners evolve into the zoo mentality. Okay, this is just one of the many places where zoo keeping and zoo animals, ocean area, all these places where we professionally keep and study animals can augment the dog trainer's professional development and professional life. Okay, so what do we do in zoos? Well, the first thing is our intention. We're not interested in competing our animals in general. We're not interested in selling their services. Okay, we even only have a limited interest in them getting along with others. So for example, like people. So the animals I've worked with have been very close with me and with the other people. And they include seals, sea lions, otters, dolphins, whales, turtles, many, many kinds of animals. They didn't include, or at least the animals that I was physically close with, did not include bears, tigers, lions. I trained those animals, but I did not train them in direct contact. So this is a huge difference because zoo animals get to be animals. So yes, we may do demonstrations or shows with them, but for 90% of their day, they get to just be who they are, including aggressive if they want to be. Because we can safely close the door on their exhibits and they're not going to harm anybody. It's not that way with your average pet. With a zoo animal, we get in there and, maybe we're with that animal for 12 hours a day by covering the day with various shifts. Sometimes even 24 hours a day. But we're never actually with that animal for 24 hours of the day. But you are with your pets for 24 hours a day in many situations. So with the pet, they have to conform enough that you can coexist peacefully in the home. So if you look at zoo animals versus pet or domestic animals, you're going to see a lot of things that aren't any different. The friendships that they form are just as deep. What they can learn is just as intricate. The reliability can be just as great. But there's a trait that pets and domestic animals have that distinguishes them from wild and zoo or exotic animals. And that is a trait called neoteny. And neoteny is neonatal, like referring to brand new baby. And if you look at the development of dogs, domesticated dogs retain a lot of the traits of a young dog, of being open to others, of being interested in what we do. They have physical traits. Like a lot of pet dogs have rounded ears instead of perky ears. And they might even have rounded faces. And they might have bigger ears and eyes than the average dog or the average wolf. There are other traits like that. But there have been researchers that have presented a case that dogs are actually kind of arrested in their development. They don't quite become fully adult in the same way that a wolf or a coyote would. So how does that affect ownership of animals? And could everybody have a wolf instead of a dog if they wanted? And the answer is not if you want to have any plants in your yard, because wolves will mark and mark and mark until they kill every dang tree that you own. So let's say there were no other considerations as to why you shouldn't keep a wolf. That's a big one, okay? And they'll dig and dig and dig, and they'll be likely to dig out of your yard. And then you have to worry about everybody else with your wolf. And there's really probably no amount of training that's going to change those traits. They're kind of really firmly entrenched. Whereas it's much more reasonable to teach a dog not to dig, or to teach a dog not to, you know, to pee in one particular place so the other plants can live in peace. All right, so we have some differences in the kind of animal. We have a big difference in what we expect of the animal. So a zoo animal has its own safe place to be, and your pet has to be where you are and with you a lot of the time and directly in your house, where if they acted like wolves, you have a miserable life. But what is really relevant, so we've talked about some ways that zoo animal keeping is not relevant to pet keeping, but here's a way that it is or could be, and that is our approach. So when I sat down to design the learning programs for my animals at the National Zoo, I made a list of all the behaviors I thought they would need to know. Now, how did I make this list? Well, the first thing I did is I used two tools, an annual timeline and a lifeline. Okay? And the lifeline is the kind of like the approximate schedule of all the major events in the animal's life that I can predict. So, first he's born. At some point, he's going to be weaned, and that's a big stressor. And for seals and sea lions, when they're weaned, they also molt, so they change their fur. And that's another big stressor. And then they have to go out and learn how to swim around and get their own food. That's another big stressor. And I'll tell you in a minute why the fact that these are big stressors are important things to note. Now, with the adults, at the time that the babies are being weaned, they're often breeding. And there can be a lot of antagonism between the various animals, so that's a big stressor. Now, let's say right after that, the population or the visitation of the zoo goes to its max for the year. We're now in, so seals and sea lions, or they're not the same. Sea lions, California sea lions, tend to produce their pups, go into the breeding form, rear their pups, wean their pups, all somewhere between April to June, July at the latest. And therefore, these are not good times to train. They're not good times to train because good luck training the animals. Breeding behavior is one of those entrenched behaviors that it's not easy to teach the animals not to engage in, nor did we want to. So we've got these animals now that actually are not candidates for training for 3 or 4 months of the year. But they still might need to do something during that time. So that means we need to have everything trained that they're going to need during those months way before it happens. That training has to be done or should be done before April, May at the latest. Okay? So then, after all this, we kind of want to ease them back into a training schedule because these things are stressful. Also, July, August, those are the hottest months, so that has its own stress. Plus, as I mentioned before, lots of people. So we are prepared to relax training standards and training goals during that time for those animals, which means the training really would kick in again September, October, November, December, January, February, March. Okay, we'd be training a lot. So during that time, we need to train everything that we need for the next year to carry us through the next breeding season. And the lifelines help us to do that. So what are some of the other events that would appear on the lifeline? So these are once in a lifetime milestones. So we had the birth, okay, and then the weaning, puberty, first breeding, maybe the first vet checkup, when we need certain husbandry behaviors. Let's say we know an animal is going to travel to another zoo, and we know when that's supposed to happen. So we need to teach that animal to understand about traveling and to feel comfortable with it before it's time for it to actually go. And then once that happens, that animal may no longer be part of our collection at a particular zoo. So for us, that's his end point. Okay? Or maybe it's like my beloved Selkie at the National Zoo. She lived to be 43 years old, the longest known living gray seal in captivity. Yay. Or as we say now, managed care. Because I will tell you, a lot of the animals that we say are in captivity come and go as they please. And we'll tell more stories about that in another podcast. Okay, so we've looked at the behaviors that happen once in the animal's life, okay, and that's the lifeline. And now we're going to take a look at the annual behaviors, or the annual line. And this is a schedule that kind of repeats itself. So every year you're going to have the coldest part of the year, and for some animals that will be stressful. And then you're going to have the change of the seasons, and that is very stressful. Did you know that more people die in April than in any other month? Like they've hung on through the whole winter, no matter how difficult that was. And now that it's starting to become beautiful and easier to live, they pass. Go figure. So other milestones in an animal's life would be likely to include annual vet checks. If you have to move animals around for, you know, take them into other pastures or combine them for breeding, separate them from being with other animals to breed. These are all things that are likely to be similar year after year. So, of course, you have all the breeding behaviors, the stress from the weather, the stress from the audiences, maybe even pollution. Then you're also going to have crazy events that you can't predict. These aren't on either one of the lines, but we make a special list. So, for example, we can't predict when this is going to happen, but one year at the National Zoo, there was a tornado that went right through the zoo, chopped down all the trees at about 8 to 11 feet high in its path. Now, we can't prepare anybody for a tornado, but there are skills that we can teach ahead of time to help us in case some kind of emergency happens. So one of the things I like to do with my animals is teach them to walk through the public area. This is both my seals and my sea lions. Took a lot of work, but I wanted to ensure that if necessary, if I needed to get my animals to safety, I could get them there even if we had to walk. Okay, so we did that training. And we also did training for things like emergency crating or learning not to go in or out of a gate on request, so that if somebody accidentally opened a gate, you could even yell out and say, so-and-so in, and yeah, you could say who you wanted to come out. So these were management skills that were really good. So now let's talk about what would definitely be on your list of behaviors. And you're going to organize them, or we did, according to priority. So the top priority is safety. You have to be able to work in direct contact with your animals safely, or the program will not go on. You know, you won't be allowed to train the animals and work with them. And so that's the very first thing we would teach. So what does that involve? Well, you have to teach the animal not to bite, not to be aggressive. You have to teach them how to walk safely with you if you're going to have that kind of contact. And of course, in this particular case, I'm not talking about the big cats and the bears and so forth. But until recently, it was what we did with elephants, okay, and with seals, sea lions, dolphins, whales, otters, and lots of other animals, lots of the ambassador animals that would go out and teach school groups and so on about the animals by giving them a chance to get up really close with animals that were younger and safer and so on for them to be with. Okay, so first is safety. Part of safety is teaching the animal what they can do if they feel too much pressure. Because you can't tell an animal, you have to stay right here and put up with this. You can tell them that you can stay here as long as you can put up with it, but if you can't put up with it, here's what you can do. We have to teach them coping skills. And there's a whole branch of Sinalia training systems called perception modification. And it's probably the most important work I've ever done. I think everybody should learn it. I think every animal should learn it. And that is part of the safety training, teaching animals to cope with stress and manage their emotions is absolutely critical for their long-term success. So safety includes teaching the animals how to direct their frustration and aggression so they're not dangerous. It's teaching them how to escape a situation so that they can cope and they can keep everybody else safe. It's teaching them how to cope with stress, manage their emotions. All right? So then the next thing is going to be teaching animals to cooperate in their daily husbandry. So maybe you need to move them from area to area so that you can clean their holding areas or their exhibit area. Maybe you need them to wait while you put their food down so it can be safe. Maybe you need them to go in and out of various crates or cages or through doors by name. And it might have to happen really quickly or under difficult situations. So let's say every once in a while, a person would just jump in with an exotic animal. Well, we don't want the animal in there with that person. So we're going to, if possible, separate the person from the animal as fast as we can. And one option to do that is to simply call the animal off exhibit into holding. So this is all husbandry behaviors. Now, other behaviors that are husbandry related would be taking care of teeth, nails, feet, fur, spraying ears so that they don't get flies, taking urine samples. Now we're getting into the medical care, and that comes right on the back of the husbandry. Teaching the animals to cooperate with medical care is the next priority. Absolutely important for their long-term health, but we don't need it as fast as we need the cooperation with the husbandry. That's why it's the third priority instead of the second. Now, once an animal learns his medical behaviors, which include giving hair samples, letting us swab inside the mouth, sometimes inside the ears, examine the eyes, examine the ears, take blood samples, give injections, put breast pumps on the animals so that we can collect milk samples, at least in our dreams, right? Sometimes they need to learn how to get their teeth brushed. They might need to allow various different exams, ultrasound. So these are all medical behaviors. They're often simple but intrusive. So to give an ultrasound, for example, we would ask the animal to usually lie on its back and allow us to put this gel on their stomach or wherever it is they wanted to look. And then you put this little cuppy-like thing on and you squish it around and so on. So the animal has to put up with all that, put up with staying in that posture for a while, having people that it's not that used to around, the vets and the techs, strange machine, maybe any noises that it makes, the gel might have a smell associated with it. So there could be a lot of different things that come together. If you have to clip or grind nails, file feet as you do with elephants, these are all behaviors that are somewhere between husbandry and medical care, but all of them we need to teach when we can, as soon as we can, so that it will support the animal in his rest of his life. Okay, so now what? We have safety and husbandry care, medical care. Now we get to work on skills and just general education. So what can we teach the animal? Oh, wow, this is fun. We can teach them the names of all the body parts, the names of everything that's around them, the other animals, the toys, the kinds of food, the props, the equipment, all the different weird devices and substances that we use. I used to take my seals and sea lions into the kitchen and show them everything that was in there. I would show the gray seals the sea lion area, you know, behind the scenes, which we needed them to come over there because that's where the scale was. So they would learn to get their weight taken. We would teach them to go into the squeeze cage. Now, here is a really important thing that I learned. And that is that by teaching the animals that they had to be calm and choose to go into the squeeze cage, and if they did, then I would start to crank it down. So the way that we did this is it was really fun, and it's kind of an art form. It's kind of like Tom Sawyer getting people to want to paint his fence. But once you start painting the fence, you realize, oh, wow, I'm getting more fit. Oh, wow, this is good for my heart. Oh, wow, I enjoy being out here. I enjoy talking. You know, there's other benefits that the animal sees. And the squeeze cage is one of those. So if the animal is not correctly trained, the squeeze cage or the chute cage can be scary to them. But if you teach the animal that it's a choice that he can explore. For example, we used to leave the doors open of the crates most of the time. And the animal could not earn the door to be closed until they lay down on the ground and get as quiet and small as they could. And then they could earn us cranking down the squeeze cage. Well, as Temple Grandin talks about in her book, Animals in Translation, the squeeze chute can be really relaxing for the animals and in her case for her as well. And my animals learned to love it. They would just get right in the cage and get themselves down as flat as they could, and so that I would crank it all the way down and they kind of get a pressure point massage. And then after, you know, like we would work together to determine how much time they wanted. And so then we would crank it back out. And sometimes they'd go back in there and lay down again, like, will you do it again? So we would. So these are the kinds of things that we can start teaching. We can develop vocabulary. Look what you can do with this. You can ask them things. You can give them choices. Do you prefer this fish or this other kind of fish? You know, would you rather have a butterfish or a look down or whiting or capelin or herring or mackerel? And you can give them choices of who they want to be with. Would you like to go see, you know, Norman? Or would you like to be in with Jenny and Esther? There's so much we can do when we teach the animals vocabulary. In addition, we can teach them special skills. Retrieval. Retrieval isn't just, look, I can teach this animal how to retrieve something for me because I'm the trainer. No. I ask the animal to retrieve foreign objects out of their exhibit because those things could harm them. And if they know I will always pay for them, and they will, and they did, just come up all of a sudden with strange things, I would take it, thank you very much, and then we would negotiate their payment, which was always generous, right? One of the most common ways that people kill animals that are in managed care is by throwing strange things in their exhibit. Everything from money to sunglasses and, rubber animals, just balloons. That's a terrible thing. Strings. All of these things are dangerous to our animals. So we want that animals that live in these exhibits to just routinely, whenever they see anything like that, bring it to us. Now, it can work to an even greater extent. I remember one time at National Zoo, the then director had a bunch of other scientists at the zoo with him, and he went to show them, his group, how the sea lions responded to people and what they knew how to do and so forth. And he accidentally threw his keys into the pool first thing. Yeah. So I was there and I went out immediately and asked Maureen to please retrieve whatever she found in the bottom of the pool. So she goes down and she comes up and she's got a leaf on her nose. And everybody's like, oh, great. Ah, it's a leaf. So we take the leaf and I send her down again. And she goes down and she brings up a bigger leaf. Well, that's a great leaf. Thank you very much. Can you try it again? And the third time she knew she had what I wanted because she didn't just come to the surface of the water. She jumped straight out of the water and there, like, you know, right at shoulder level is Maureen's muzzle with the keys. She's got the keys in her teeth. And I said, thank you, in a single motion and handed them to the director. And Maureen got a commendation. I got a bottle of champagne. It was a good trade. So if Maureen hadn't gotten the keys, they could have been a danger to the animals who might swallow them. So other things that we could teach the animals to do would be things like more advanced communication, discrimination, being able to tell us what sounds they could hear, what colors they could see, so we could directly study with their assistance because of their communication skills. We could teach them to do things they love to do that allow them to show people what they're capable of. Everything from speed swims to coming out of the water to their personal place, because all our animals had their own place. And we could have the entire group give them a signal, and they'd all come bursting out of the water and go straight to their own place, which was very dramatic and beautiful to see. We could ask them to jump or do acrobatic behaviors, to, even possibly, I didn't personally train this, but you could ask a mother to move a baby from one place to another. Not for long, but during a certain point, they're capable of doing that, and it's a normal part of their behavior, which people love to see. We can co-parent with the animals. Okay, so there's more things, games, challenging behaviors like puzzles, activities like getting a certain amount of exercise. All of these things come under tasks. Now, once we teach those tasks, that's the fourth priority, right? And the fifth priority is to teach the animals to be able to do these things wherever they are. So let's say the animal has to go up to the zoo hospital for some reason. You want them to be able to function at the zoo hospital and not be totally stressed out and frightened. Or maybe they're traveling and they need to feel comfortable to operate the way they normally would, even though they're traveling. There could be other reasons that they need to be able to operate someplace else. Maybe they go to another zoo. Maybe they have to get moved. Maybe they change the exhibits at the zoo where they live. So these are all reasons that we need to expand the environments in which the animal can work. And then finally, just because it's fun. Just because it helps them to show people how amazing they are. Now, this is how we staked out our entire training plan. First, we looked at the events and what we needed to train to prepare the animals for those events, both the predictable ones for the life or the year, but also the unpredictable things like what's going to happen in case of a fire, what's going to happen in case of a tornado, what's going to happen in case of a lockdown, etc. Then for all of these situations, we list the behaviors that we need that animal to understand. Now, don't want to go too far into this, but I do want to tell you that that is just the beginning of the behavior plan process. And in the behavior planning, what we do is we take all those behaviors, we divide them into modules, all the little pieces. We then teach the modules individually according to how much we need each module. So the modules are taught in a specific order so that we get the most bang for our buck with our training. So let's say a single target would give you an animal recall, come to me. But it would also give you go over this obstacle, do this high jump, get up on this chair, get into this crate. Can you lie down for a seal or a sea lion? A single target will do that for you. So a single target is one of the very first things you're going to teach because it's part of many, many, many other behaviors. So another component that's part of a lot of different behaviors is duration. Understanding how long you need to maintain a behavior for and having the ability and the patience to do that. So for example, to examine a sea lion's eyes, I probably need about 10 seconds. To give him an injection, probably 3 to 5 seconds. But to take blood, I want to have 3 or 4 minutes of time. So we have to develop the animal's ability to do all those things. And once we've taught the various components, we keep getting behaviors kind of precipitating out, like a single target with height is a high jump. A single target and low is going to be lying down. And so it goes. And by the time I get done, I have a list of all these components, and then to the side, all the behaviors that are going to get created at certain points because of the components I've already taught. Okay, this is a great way to organize the training of any animal with a career. So the first thing they need to learn are just like the zoo animals. It would be so great if puppy training classes didn't just socialize the puppies, but got them started on vocabulary and started teaching them concepts of duration or time, distance, direction. Do you know it only takes about 1 minute to teach an animal to understand left versus right, over versus under, around versus between? These are all things that are pretty easy to teach, and there's no reason to wait for them. So, with animals, with dogs and other domestic animals, if we sit down and make a list of all the behaviors that we need to teach them in order for them to be well prepared for their lives, turns out it's really fast and easy to actually teach those behaviors. For example, we have been known to teach 13 body parts in a minute. And it's amazing to me that they actually can retain that information. Now, I'm not saying I'd always just expect that, but we have seen that happen. So we'll sequentially just start teaching body parts right away. What would be the benefits to your clients' dogs if they actually understood about their body parts and they understood about the examinations and the blood samplings and all these things and were in a position to cooperate with the people? What if they understood about grooming and duration, that you have to hold still for X a number of seconds so that they can safely snip around the animal's face, eyes? You do not want the dog turning around like this while you've got scissors pointed at its face. So when you wait for someone to come to you because they have a problem, you're being responsive. But when you interest your clients in developing their life with their animals, you're being proactive. And as you solve their problems, but also teach additional skills, the beautiful thing is that the people who didn't want to be animal trainers in the beginning, and they just wanted their pet fixed, all of a sudden, they're creating a new life and a new relationship with their animals. All of a sudden, they're enjoying having an animal and doing things that their animal's really good at, whether it's search and recovery or protection dog sports or agility or obedience, scenting, tracking. There's all kinds of things that animals do with and for us. Herding is a big one. So why not get that dog started? Because the sooner that dog connects with his passion and gets to express himself in those directions, the sooner he really just discovers this joie de vivre, this love of being in every day of his wonderful life. And that's a lot of fun to live with. So the people then have something more interesting to do with their animals. They become proud of their animals. Everybody gets more exercise. It's more interesting. The interactions are friendly and fun instead of tortured and suffering, and it's really good for everyone. Now, because we know how to make this really fast and easy for everyone, it's easy to interest clients in doing this once they get a taste for how well all this can work and how beneficial it can be. So I hope that for my colleagues that are primarily dog trainers, There's something here that encourages and inspires you to be able to kind of flow into a new area of endeavor with your clients, where you're expert at solving their problems and now have some additional tools or incentives to help them into a new position of living their dream life with their animals. So you go from getting rid of the pain that they had with their animals, and now you're going to open up their delight with their animals. And we often don't get a chance to do that with pet owners. So let me know if you do this, if you already do it, what worked for you, and let me know if you try any of these things and what you find with them. All right, thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for joining us. Come back for more news and views on animal training and living with animals. Stay at the top of the pack with Casey. This is Joseph Laughlin, producer of Training with Casey. See you next time.